From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet writer, producer, and director Arthur Lawrence. He wrote the books for the hit musicals Gypsy and West Side Story. Now he's directed the current Broadway revival of Gypsy, starring Tyne Daly. Also, journalist Michael Norman tells us about the men he fought beside during the Vietnam War and his recent reunion with them. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews works by violinist Joseph Sigeti, newly reissued on compact disc. And we find out what happens when linguist Jeffrey Nunberg puts poetry to music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush tonight is expected to unveil a proposal for additional troop cuts in Europe. The White House says the president will announce plans to cut another 50,000 American forces from current troop reduction proposals. His plan, reportedly driven by the collapse of communist governments in Eastern Europe, would reduce forces for each side to 195,000 troops. The former head of the Mexican Federal Judicial Police and four others were indicted by a federal grand jury in Los Angeles today on charges of murder in the 1985 death of drug agent Enrique Camarena. Manuel Ibarra Herrera was among five defendants named in the indictment returned today. A total of 19 people have been variously charged with kidnapping, drug trafficking, and murder in connection with Camarena's death in Guadalajara. The president of El Salvador was in the United States today at the United Nations, the first stop in a six-day U.S. visit aimed at improving his country's image. Andy Lancet reports from the U.N.
Salvadoran President Alfredo Cristiani met with U.N. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar to discuss a U.N. role in stalled peace talks between the government and rebel leaders. Cristiani said he expects the Secretary General to be more than a witness at such talks, but not necessarily a mediator. The rebel FMLN has asked that Perez de Cuellar take on that role. The Salvadoran president also said he was satisfied with his government's handling of the case involving Salvadoran soldiers and the death of six Jesuit priests last November.
The present government of El Salvador is not willing to accept violence as a means to solve any problems.
Cristiani is scheduled to meet with President Bush tomorrow and said he would not ask for additional aid. For National Public Radio, this is Andy Lancet at the United Nations.
Coast Guard says one of its cutters opened fire on a Cuban-owned freighter in international waters off the Gulf of Mexico today. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Coast Guard cutter Chincoteague was on a routine patrol in the Gulf when it spotted the freighter, the MV Herman. The ship, registered in Panama, fit the profile of a vessel smuggling drugs, and Coast Guard officials asked to board it. When refused, the Coast Guard asked permission of Panama to fire a warning shot across the freighter's bow. When that didn't work, the Coast Guard received permission to open fire on the Herman. Coast Guard spokesman Nick Sandifer.
Some 250 or 300 rounds of M60 machine gun fire was used, and some 130 or so rounds of 20-millimeter cannon were also used.
No one was injured in the attack, and the freighter was able to make it to the Mexican port of Tampico. Cuba says the Herman was carrying a load of chromium, not drugs. U.S. officials have asked Mexican authorities to board the ship. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 47 points today to close at 2590.5. Advances led declines 11 to 4. This is NPR News. There is now a real danger of civil war in the southern Yugoslav province of Kosovo. Today, three more demonstrators were reported killed, bringing the death toll in the latest wave of fighting to at least 30. Mass demonstrations have also been held in Serbia and Montenegro, demanding that the federal government take action to quell the uprising. Pierre Vickery reports from Zagreb.
The violence in Kosovo, once restricted to isolated pockets, has now spread to the whole province, with demonstrations in nearly all towns and villages. Three demonstrators are reported to have been killed today, as thousands of ethnic Albanians again wage bitter street battles with riot police. In other parts of Yugoslavia, Serbs and Montenegrins stage huge rallies, demanding that the federal authorities send in the army to quell the unrest. If this is not done within 24 hours, they threaten to send their own armed vigilantes into Kosovo to fight the Albanians. Recruiting centers report hundreds of angry volunteers signing up to fight. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb, Yugoslavia.
South African President F.W. de Klerk ordered a judicial inquiry today into allegations that police carried out authorized killings of anti-apartheid activists. De Klerk's decision to investigate the alleged police hit squads comes less than 2 months after he refused to appoint such a commission. The controversy began late last year when three former policemen said they participated in the killings of government opponents under authorization of their superiors. The police have denied the existence of hit squads. The chairman of New York's Metropolitan Transportation Authority said today the MTA is appealing a judge's decision that allows people to ask for money in the subways. MTA Chairman Robert Kiley says begging lends an air of disorder to the New York subway. Kiley says he believes the judge was wrong when he ruled that begging is a free speech right. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Gypsy is back on Broadway. The role of Rose, the quintessential stage mother, is being played by Tyne Daly of Cagney and Lacey fame. Ethel Merman was Rose in the original 1959 Broadway production. Gypsy has one of Broadway's great scores, with songs like Everything's Coming Up Roses, Some People, and Small World. Julie Stein wrote the music, Stephen Sondheim the lyrics. My guest, Arthur Lawrence, wrote the book. It was based on the memoirs of stripper Gypsy Rose Lee. Lawrence is also directing the current revival of Gypsy. His other Broadway credits include writing the book for West Side Story and directing La Cage aux Folles, I Can Get It For You Wholesale, and Anyone Can Whistle. Lawrence also wrote screenplays for several films, including The Way We Were, The Turning Point, and Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. I asked Arthur Lawrence why he decided to do a revival of Gypsy.
Because I was asked to, and I love the show, and enough time had passed that the show could finally be done the way I thought it should be done. When it originally played in New York, it was considered a very tough, unpleasant show, and the production was really rather sweet. It laid off a lot of things that, it being 1989, I was able to do. It's very different from the other productions. It goes much more deeply into the relationships, into what I would call the dark side of it.
What's an example of something that was too unpleasant for the original production that you could go into now?
Well, it still is. I mean, Mother is still sacrosanct in America. And a lot of people don't like seeing this woman who is not the most pleasant mother in the world. But also there is the relationship between Rose and Herbie the agent is extremely sexual now. It has elements of romance, but it's distinctly a man-woman relationship. That was never played before.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the original production, Ethel Merman starred as Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from what I've read about the original production, you weren't really satisfied with her performance.
You didn't read that anyplace.
Well, what I read was that you referred to her as an opening night performer, someone who gave her all on opening night.
Yes, she gave her all, but...
After that, it kind of diminished a little bit.
That's true. I'm very grateful to Merman because I don't think they would have done the show without her,
mm-hmm.
even though she was on the skids, as it were, at that time. She had had a flop or two, and as a matter of fact, the show opened with almost no advance. And if we hadn't gotten good reviews... David Merrick, the producer, told me we'd play 6 weeks and that was it. She did us a great service. And for that time, she was terrific. But it was never what I felt the performance should be.
Well, I read that one night you had a talk with her in front of the whole cast about her performance, about her not giving her all. What did you say to her?
I don't know where you read that.
I think it was in Sondheim and Company.
Well, it's only semi-true.
Mm-hmm.
What it was, I don't think she wasn't really an actress. She didn't know she had taken to walking through the show. But what I called her on was that she and Jack Klugman, who was played opposite her, the show had been running 6 months, and they were breaking up on stage, telling each other jokes, which I think is insulting to an audience. The audience comes, make them laugh, not each other. And I called her on that.
What was her reaction?
Oh, it was as though she were a naughty little child who'd been spanked. She took it.
Mm-hmm.
Went right on doing it again.
Now, you directed the 1973 London production
of
Gypsy with Angela Lansbury.
Right.
And I just know this production through the cast recording, which I think is wonderful. Tell me about casting Angela Lansbury in the part and directing her in the role of Rose.
That, again, was totally different. She's a very fine actress, and they wanted to do the show in London. It had never been played in London because when it originally opened, Merman was going to do it in London, and then some agent unwisely convinced her, and she unwisely said it, let herself be convinced, that she was so terrific that she should go on a concert tour of the United States. So she refused to do it in London. They would have no substitutes, and her concert tour did not do well, which is the understatement of this interview. So it had never been done in London, and they wanted to see it. And the producers wanted Angie. I knew her. I'd worked with her before. And we did it in London. And again, it was different from this production because the emphasis was more on the comedic quality. She's a really terrific comedian, Angela. And Rose was quite a reach for her. There's a kind of earthiness, if you will, trashiness about Rose that's very difficult for Angela to get. But in her own terms, she was terrific. There was no relationship between her, again, and the agent.
Tyne Daly is starring in Gypsy, in the current production of Gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you knew she could sing before before you gave
She
her
came in an audition for us.
Uh-huh. Were you surprised?
Yes, very. And she sang for Julie Stein, Steve Sondheim, Barry Brown, the producer. It was his idea. She was his idea, and myself, and we were all very surprised.
Is a TV star considered an advantage or a liability on Broadway?
I don't know how Broadway considers it. In my opinion, it can be a liability. It is not an advantage. A TV star doesn't sell tickets. I think there are two reasons. One is usually TV stars schlep around productions in summer stock. They're shoddy. And the people have gotten burned. And they also see these people for free. Then it comes to New York, and they think, well, there's a snobbery. I must say in many cases justified in New York that a TV star simply doesn't have the background. In Tyne's case, what helped a lot was that she was on the road with this for 26 weeks before it came in, which was very valuable time to learn how to perform in musical theater and to learn how to perform Rose.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book for the Broadway musical Gypsy and directed the 1973 London production of it and is directing the current Broadway production of Gypsy, which stars Tyne Daly. There are wonderful songs in Gypsy. Now, I've heard Stephen Sondheim, who wrote the lyrics for Gypsy, say that he sometimes likes to incorporate lines from the script right into a song, so that the lyric is really speaking the mind of the librettist, the person who wrote the book. Did that happen in Gypsy?
It happened a lot. Steve is wonderful to collaborate with, and he thinks I am, because I say, go ahead, raid the dialogue. For example, the first line of Mr. Goldstone, have a Negro Mr. Goldstone, was taken from the dialogue. But he means really more than that. He is one of the too few lyricists who knows that each character speaks differently and sings differently. They have a different diction. So he waits, or he waited in the case of Gypsy, for example, till I would write the characters. He would see how they would speak. That affected what lyrics he wrote for them. Their language is different.
When you're writing the book for a musical, do you have a sense in your mind of where the songs belong and what the transition into the song is going to be like?
Total. That's the way I write. I plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
I do as much as possible to write into the music. Let the music take over. Lift the characters to the point where they can't do anything else but sing.
Can you give us an example?
Yes. At the end of the first act of Gypsy, there's a song called Everything's Coming Up Roses, which, if you haven't seen the show, you think is a kind of happy, jazzy Broadway tune. What happens with that song is one of the reasons why I don't want it, and we all don't want it to be made into a movie again. What is done with that song you can only do on the stage. You can't do it in the movies because movies are too literal. What happens is a woman literally goes off her rocker and bursts into that song. This is a woman who suddenly has an enormous disappointment. She's furious, she's angry, she rages, and she rages until she can't anymore, and it comes out musically. It's against the emotion. It's all this ridiculous, insane optimism that this woman has. And it's done in music.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we listen to Everything's Coming Up Roses? Angela Lansbury singing. This is from the London production that you directed in 1973.
And just remember that listening to her
are
her daughter and her lover, and they are terrified and stunned by this woman's madness.
I had a dream about you, baby. It's gonna come true, baby. They think that we're through, but baby, you'll be swell, you'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now, honey, everything's coming up roses. Clear the decks, clear the tracks. You've got nothing to do but relax. Blow a kiss, take a bow, honey, everything's coming up roses. Now's your inning.
That's Angela Lansbury from the 1973 production of Gypsy, which was directed by my guest Arthur Lawrence. Arthur Lawrence also wrote the book for Gypsy and is directing the current production of Gypsy on Broadway, which stars Tyne Daly. He also wrote the book for West Side Story and the screenplays for The Way We Were, The Turning Point, and Rope. His directing credits include La Cage aux Folles, I Can Get It for You Wholesale, and Anyone Can Whistle. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Arthur Lawrence is my guest. Do you ever feel that the librettist gets the least credit in a musical? You know, in a musical, you always hear so much more sometimes about the songwriters.
Every librettist feels that, and it's accurate. No musical is ever referred to as the work of the librettist. It is only referred to in terms of the composer and, if the lyricist is as famous as Steve Sondheim, the lyricist. I think that goes back to opera, where you don't know who wrote the libretto for the operas. Mm-hmm. You only know the composer. And I think one of the reasons we don't have more and better playwrights writing musicals is that everybody has a need for recognition, which is, by the way, what Gypsy is really about. And it is so frustrating not to get any recognition for what one has done in creating a musical that a lot of playwrights simply won't try. And you get the people write letters to the Times and the critics say, oh, yes, and then for 2 minutes they recognize the librettist and then they don't.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply a given. The reason I do it is I just love musical theater. And I love writing them. I'm stuck.
Let me ask you about the book that you wrote for West Side Story. Now, I believe the idea for a musical based on Romeo and Juliet was the choreographer Jerome Robbins.
That's right.
Well, how did he originally pitch it to you? What was the initial idea he proposed?
The initial idea was quite different from what it was. It was about a Jewish girl and a Catholic boy in New York over Easter and Passover. And I thought that was AB's Irish Rose, and I wanted no part of it. And then several years passed, and I happened to be in California, and Lenny Bernstein was in California. By that time, juvenile delinquent gangs had come into being. And on the coast, there was a great problem with Chicanos, which in New York was Puerto Ricans. That's where the idea came from, the front page. And that's what the... And then Lenny and I called Jerry and said, we're ready to go.
Did you have any reservations about singing and dancing gangs?
On the stage, no. In the movie, yes.
Mm-hmm.
On the stage, the stage is total illusion. You come into a box, and you see this proscenium, and then people hop on and hop off. There's an orchestra in the pit. But people have imagination, and the theater makes you use it. And you will accept almost anything. But movies, to me, are either... The nature of the medium is such that movies are either realistic, by that I mean naturalistic, or surrealistic. To me, in the movie A West Side Story, I know it was a great hit, but when those boys came tour-jeteing down the street, I didn't believe it for a minute. I still don't.
Now, you didn't write the screenplay for either Gypsy or West Side Story. Did you want to?
I wasn't asked to write the screenplay for West Side Story, and I wanted to. I was asked to write the screenplay for Gypsy, and I was going to till they told me they cast Rosalind Russell, and the director was Mervyn LeRoy, and I bowed out. We had wanted Judy Garland. They didn't because they said she had a weight problem. But of course, with the passage of time, Gypsy covers 15 years, even if she had a weight problem. If the white weight went up and down, it wouldn't have mattered.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of the movie?
Of Gypsy?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's a candidate for one of the worst movies I ever saw.
So, you know, a lot
it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. The only good thing in the movie was Natalie Wood.
Uh-huh.
R.I.P.
Well, just give me a sense of what you hate about the film.
Well, Rosalind Russell was very busy being Rosalind Russell. Again, she was wonderful in Wonderful Town. She's wonderful when she played this, what they used to call a dame. This hard-driving, executive, smart-cracking, certainly middle-class, if not upper-middle-class, woman. This is nothing from this blousy, vulgar, common, trashy Rose. I mean, she wore chic clothes. I remember her black and white high heels in the train station. It was just all off.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, is there going to be a cast recording of the new production of
Yes,
Gypsy?
There is. It's made.
Oh, it's made already?
Yep.
Is it out?
No. It's being mixed and decibeled.
Okay. How do you prepare for it as the director? Do you give people different directions for the cast recording?
What I did in this case was try, since the Tyndaley is not essentially or primarily a singer, but a singing actress, I try to have the emphasis in the album be on acting so that there is much more dialogue, much more of a feeling of a show than there was in any of the other albums. This is the third, which is some kind of a record. I don't know whether it's a desirable record, but it's a record. And to, as I say, there's a lot of dialogue which enables you to begin with the acting and go seamlessly, I hope, into the singing.
Now, you're the director. Do you go night after night to the theater?
I certainly do not. I'm working on a new show, happily, gladly.
When is it time for you to stop going?
Never. I go back every certain number of weeks to check up on them and, as in the immortal words of George Kaufman, remove the improvements.
So the new musical that you're working on now is...
Nick and Nora.
This is based on The Thin Man?
Based on the characters, just those two characters in The Thin Man. The story is entirely new, and it has a score by Charles Strauss and Richard Maltby, Jr.
Now, how do you turn Nick and Nora Charles into the characters of a musical? What makes the story a musical?
That is one of those imponderables. It depends on if you see it that way. To me, these are two people, when I tell you this phrase, you'll see what makes it a musical. To me, these are two people who were dancing through life. Now, the difference in the stage version and the movies is to me they've been married 5 years and the steps are beginning to change, and they're beginning to stumble here and there. But you see, the minute you say dancing, you get a visual, it's a metaphor, but it's also a reality. Their first entrance, they literally come dancing in.
You've written for movies and for the stage. Mm-hmm. What are some of the primary differences between writing for the two forms?
The other day, there was a movie I was considering writing. Oliver Stone was going to produce it, and he called me up and said, "Why don't you want to do it?" I said, because the day I finish the script, I'm out on my ass. I wrote my first movie in, I think, 1948. This is now 1990. There's a lot of talk, but essentially, the attitude has not changed. The writer is low man on the totem pole. Would they woo you and they'll pursue you? He's the least paid comparatively of the actors and the directors. And the great God in Hollywood, as in this country, is money. That determines respect. And once they have the script, as it says in Gypsy, so long, Rose, don't slam the door as you leave. You're out. And they do. Not only do they cast and play it as they want, they rewrite it as they want.
Now, one of your screenplays, The Way We Were, which you also wrote a novel of the same name, there's blacklisting in that, in Hollywood. Were you ever blacklisted yourself?
Absolutely, in The Witch Hunt. Mm-hmm. And there's an example of what they do. The climactic scene in that story, in that movie, was shot and neatly cut out.
What was the scene?
The scene was where the Barbra Streisand character says to the Robert Redford character, he says to her, "The studio says I have a subversive wife, and they will fire me unless you go and become an informer." And he wants her to inform, to save his butt. And she says, well, there's a very simple solution. Willy-nilly, circumstances force you into this. I will get a divorce. You won't have a subversive wife. What they kept was willy-nilly, circumstances force you into a solution. I will get a divorce. The whole business about informing and subversion, which was what the picture was basically about, they cut out. They said the public doesn't want it. They want a romance. How did they know? I don't know. Maybe they looked in a crystal ball. But it's so unsatisfying. The picture was a great success. But what I wanted to say in that picture, what the picture was about, gets thrown out with the garbage. So it's not very interesting, exciting, fulfilling. I could go on with the words for me to work in movies. The theater with all its handicaps is exciting and bigger challenge, and you can do more and you have more fun.
Well, I wish you continued success with the current production of Gypsy, and good luck with your future production as well of Nick and Nora. Thank you so much, Arthur Lawrence, for talking with us.
Thank you.
Arthur Lawrence is directing the current Broadway revival of Gypsy, which stars Tyne Daly. Lawrence also wrote the book for the musical. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be John Hockenberry. He's just returned to the U.S. after covering the Middle East for 2 years for National Public Radio News. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During his 13 months in the Vietnam War, Michael Norman saw his share of pain, fear, and death. He also saw men at their best and bravest. Coming up, Norman tells us about tracking down his comrades in arms to renew their friendship in peacetime. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz plays us new reissues of performances by Joseph Sigetti, one of the greatest violinists of the century. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg sings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. President Bush will propose new deep cuts in U.S. and Soviet combat troops in Europe during his State of the Union address this evening. The Associated Press also says Mr. Bush will warn Democrats not to try to cut Social Security taxes and set some lofty goals for American schools during his speech to a joint session of Congress. White House officials are also reported as saying the president will use the speech to prod Congress to take action on a capital gains tax cut and on legislation on clean air, child care, and crime. All of those issues are pending from last year. The House Committee Investigating Abuses at the Housing and Urban Development Department has scheduled new hearings. NPR's Mara Liasson has this report.
The committee has asked James Hamernick to appear. Hamernick was the former director of the Office of Insured Multifamily Housing Development at HUD. Investigators want to ask Hamernick about his relationship with Lance Wilson. Wilson was a top aide to former HUD Chief Samuel Pierce. Both Wilson and Pierce were subpoenaed to appear before the committee to testify about charges of influence peddling and political favoritism at HUD, but both invoked their Fifth Amendment rights and refused to testify. Congressional Democrats have asked Attorney General Dick Thornburgh to name a special prosecutor to investigate Pierce. Thornburgh has had 60 days to review that request. The 60 days ends tonight, and tomorrow Thornburgh is expected to announce whether he will seek the appointment of a prosecutor for Pierce. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The former head of the Mexican Federal Judicial Police and four others have been indicted by a U.S. federal grand jury on murder charges in the death of Drug Enforcement Agent Enrique Camarena Salazar. The Justice Department says Manuel Ibarra Herrera was one of five defendants named in the indictment returned by the federal grand jury in Los Angeles. The former head of the Mexican branch of Interpol was also indicted. A Virginia judge has postponed indefinitely ruling on whether or not to drop roughly $64 million in fines against the United Mine Workers. The fines were levied last year during the coal miners' ongoing strike against the Pittston Company. Susan Leffler reports from Lebanon, Virginia.
When the UMW and Pittston signed a tentative settlement in January, they agreed to ask for a dismissal of all fines against the union. This is to be done before the rank and file vote on the contract. A miner who asked not to be identified says he's disappointed, but he's not discouraged.
We're going to stay. We're not giving up on this. There's too many people that donated too much of their time, their money, and their effort to fight this battle, and we're here to fight.
Both the union and Pittston asked the court to drop the fines, and neither side would comment on the judge's decision to delay the hearing. For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Leffler in Lebanon, Virginia.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today as the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 47 points to close at 2590.54. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new set of historic performances by his favorite violinist, Joseph Sigetti. Sigetti was born in Hungary just before the turn of the century and died at the age of 80 in 1973. He was a champion of modern music, but was most renowned for his interpretations of the classics.
Compact discs have revitalized the recording industry. So many small record labels have sprung up all over the world. One side effect is the proliferation of unnecessary duplications. The current Schwann catalog lists 48 recordings of Vivaldi's Four Seasons and 50 recordings of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony. But one positive result is the quantity of rare historic recordings being reissued. And because of the high technical standards of the best CDs, manufacturers have begun to take extraordinary care in remastering old records. Some of them have never sounded better. A British label called Biddulph is actually a subsidiary of a violin company, and it has just issued two marvelous CD collections by one of the greatest violinists of this century, Joseph Sigetti. Sigetti was a great pioneer in the performance of Bach. He's one of the first violinists who played complete Bach solo violin sonatas rather than single movement encores. So let's listen to the presto from Sigetti's 1931 recording of Bach's complete solo violin sonata in G minor. Sigetti had three things going for him that, to my mind, make him the greatest violinist I've ever heard. He had an unmistakable tone, the most complex, vocal sound you could ever hear on a stringed instrument. He also had one of the liveliest senses of rhythm of practically any musician who ever recorded. The one thing you can't hear on a brief excerpt is his profound understanding of how every detail of a work served the grand overall design. Some critics call this kind of playing intellectual, but aren't the most intelligent musicians the ones who know exactly how to transform the notes into pure emotional energy? Take this movement, marked parlando, or speaking, from Bartók's Hungarian folk tunes. That's Bartók himself, Sigetti's friend and countryman, at the piano. The four discs that make up these two volumes called The Art of Joseph Sigetti include complete sonatas by Bach, Tartini, Handel, Mozart, Weber, and Brahms, as well as showpieces like The Flight of the Bumblebee and the Paganini Caprices, not usually associated with Sigetti, or light salon music by Fritz Kreisler. The CDs show how sly and charming this serious musician could be in a lighter vein. Sigetti was also a champion of new music. He plays such extremely attractive 20th century works as Peter Warlock's Capriole Suite, Bartók's Romanian folk dances, and shorter pieces by a surprising array of modern composers, Elgar, Debussy, Ravel, Mio, Chabrier, Defaya, Bloch, Prokofiev, Stravinsky. Sigetti was the first to record many of these. Here's one of the sweetest pieces on the album, 20th century, yet irresistibly melodic. It's Stravinsky's Pastorale. The pianist is Sigetti's son-in-law, Nikita Magaloff. Thank you.
Joseph Sigeti playing Stravinsky's Pastorale from a new reissue of his performances on the British Biddulph label. Let me spell that for you. That's B-I-D-D-U-L-P-H. Our critic Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. The battle for Bridge 28 along the Quangtri River was a bloody three-day fight that wounded or killed half of Michael Norman's Marine Company. Norman came back to the States from Vietnam intact. In 1984, when he was a columnist for the New York Times, Norman decided to track down the men from his platoon who survived the 1968 battle. His memoir, These Good Men, chronicles the search and subsequent reunion. I asked him why he wanted to get together with his Marine buddies.
Well, there were two reasons, essentially. One, I think all men who come home from war, who have ever come home from any war, for that matter, come home bewildered. And that bewilderment can last for a very long time, in my case, 10 to 15 years. You have a sense that you've gone through a monumental experience, and having gone through that, one figures that one must have learned something from that. And I wanted to know what it was that I had learned on the battlefield. And the second thing that that set me on my search was a longing to be close to the men that I once knew well on the battlefield. When men are together on the battlefield, there's nothing to keep them apart. There's no competition for jobs. There's no women. There is no family. There's not even very much ego involved. And you get closer to those men than you get closer to just about anybody else in the world. And I longed for that. I wanted some of that again.
What were the initial responses you got from the men when you tracked them down, called them up, or sent them a letter and suggested that you get together? Was everybody enthusiastic about it?
For the most part, I think the story of the first man is might be the most interesting. His name's Craig Belknap, and he was hurt the worst of all of us, terribly wounded at Bridge 28. We talked for a while, and at first he kind of didn't remember me, and then he instantly did after his memory was jogged. And then I said to him, Craig, I'm somewhat reluctant to, you know, go through with this project because I feel like an interloper. I don't want to stir up the memory of these other men if they don't want their memories stirred up. And he said to me, you've got to do it. You can't worry about that. You just got to do what you think is right. And as it turned out, they had the same longing I did. They were just absolutely delighted. They had the same hundred questions that I did. Questions as simple as, you know, where were you when, and questions as fundamental as, you know, what do we go on to do with our lives now?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I really value about friends from the past, old friends, is that they help you figure out what it is you imagined that happened to you and what actually happened. 'Cause you know the feeling of sometimes not knowing
Yes.
if you made something up or not?
Yes.
How did your memories of the war change? Were there stories that had existed in your mind that you found out weren't quite the way it happened? Did you get a different sense of what the truth really was?
Yeah. Actually, one story in particular. I thought that there was a lieutenant that I was particularly angry with during the course of the battle, whose behavior I thought was not quite right. I thought he was not aggressive enough, and that some men got hurt because of that. And as it turned out, my memory of that night was not exactly correct. But I guess my anger at him over the years had been so intense that it had literally changed my memory of the events. So you're quite correct. One of the interesting things about going back over old ground is that it doesn't quite turn in the same way that you remembered it.
So for that, you experienced relief. Was there another circumstance in which, in looking back at the past, you experienced more regret and realized you didn't act as well as you thought you had?
No, I don't think so. You know, it's an interesting question, and I'll tell you why. I don't think there's a man who has ever gone into battle that afterward doesn't question his own actions. Did I move fast enough at the second I should have moved? Was I in the place that I should have been? one of the characters in the book who's dead, who sort of informs the book, is a kid who took my place 2 hours before the battle in the line of march. I was sort of promoted up. And he walked out into a spot and was killed, and in effect walked into my spot and was killed. After he was, as he was shot, he yelled out on the radio for me to help him. He screamed out my name, and I desperately wanted to get forward, but couldn't. I couldn't get one of the officers to move the company forward as quickly as I wanted to. I might have been wrong. Who knows? But so I have thought about that. Of course, that has haunted me, and I think you won't find a man who has seen heavy combat that isn't haunted by the same kind of memory.
You mentioned the Marine who took your place when you were promoted and who was killed in that battle for Bridge 28. His name was Jim Payne. And after the war, you actually tried to contact his father so you could share with him the real story of what happened and in a way, I guess, confess that sense of guilt which haunted you. But the father didn't want to meet with you about it. Would you tell us what happened?
I called him up, and I said, his name was Andrew James Payne, Sr., and I said, "Mr. Payne, this is Mike Norman," and sort of explained the situation, and I said, I'd like to come out to San Diego, where they were living at the time, or Glenfield, actually, and visit you. And he said, "Look, I got to tell you, it's just too damn hard. I can't do it, Mike, and, the other day I just took the last box of Jim's clothes out of the house and gave them away to the Salvation Army, and it's too damn hard. I can't go back through it again." And, you know, obviously I respected his wishes, and but I didn't want to close the door quite yet myself. And I don't like to use the word healing because I don't think it was more than that. I think I moved from a state of darkness, if you will, to use a simple metaphor, into a state of light. That is to say, from a state of confusion and bewilderment into what I think now is a state of understanding. I think I understand now what happened to us. I understand now that it's possible to bring something off of the battlefield other than a profound sense of loss and an excruciating sense of waste. And I think what you bring off the battlefield is the knowledge that I have seen human beings at the best you will ever see human beings. I have seen that men stripped right down to their humanity, and I will never see men act as noble and as fine as I saw them act in Vietnam.
You organized a reunion at your house for the men that you contacted. And I'm wondering about how the dynamics between you changed in peacetime, in a backyard reunion. What I'm thinking of is, you know, on the battlefield, the relationships are based on partially on strength and power and bravery and medical ability, being quick-witted, and then, you know, in a backyard talking 20 years later, it's just different. You know, someone doesn't have to medevac you out. Someone doesn't have to pull you in from the gunfire. Do you know what I mean? The dynamics must completely change.
Yeah, they do. Actually, if, we've all sort of seen each other now over the course of the last 5 years since I began to reach out to these guys. What draws us together now, of course, is a common sense of history. But what also keeps us together now is this, and I know I don't want to sound misty-eyed about this, but I get a sense of peace when I'm in the company of these other men. I wish I knew where that came from. I think I'm just, thank God it's there. It's just, it's quite a remarkable thing.
Physically, what surprised you about the men who you fought with?
Well, I'm going to go back to this—the first guy that I talked to, and in many ways, the man that I've become closest to since, Craig Belknap. When I first went to visit him at his house in Mesquite, Texas, the first night we talked for 4 or 5 hours, and long about midnight, we began to talk about his wounds. And at one point, he got up from his chair, and he took off all his clothes, and he was standing naked before me on the rug, explaining his scars to me. And you know, his body was just horribly scarred, and I looked up at him and thought to myself, this is the part of the war that I missed. You know, I spent 13 months in combat, but other than a few scratches and a bout with malaria, I came home whole. But this is the part of the war that I missed, the suffering of it. And I must say to you, looking at him, I began to ache. I physically began to ache. And I got an understanding about the war that I never had before. a profound understanding that I never had before.
So did the reunion make you feel lucky, lucky to be whole, lucky by comparison?
Yes. Whenever you think of the dead and the wounded, you feel extraordinarily lucky. And I think the men who survive and come home, without saying so, make up their minds to lead useful, meaningful lives. It's almost like you have an obligation to do something with your life, having been lucky enough to survive the battlefield. And I think every time that one of them doesn't perform up to his own expectations, whatever it is he's doing, I think that that's going on in the back of his mind, that, I made it, God damn it, I better do something with my life.
You know, we were talking about old friends and how you get together and talk about the past and kind of figure out what really happened and what you imagined over the years. What I find sometimes is after you've gone over those memories a certain number of times, you can't really talk about them anymore. You have to move on to the present. And at some point, a relationship that's based in the past redefines itself, and either there's a base in the present or the relationship starts to fade. Do you feel like you've been able to do that with your Marine friends, to build a relationship that has a foot in the present as well as the past?
Yes, particularly the guys on the East Coast, we get together, two or three times a year now, and there's absolutely almost no storytelling. The history is taken for granted, I guess, is the simplest, quickest way to express it.
Well, Michael Norman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Michael Norman is a freelance writer and author of These Good Men, Friendships Forged from War. It's published by Crown. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Linda, it's State of the Union night.
A big night for President Bush, who will report to the Congress on the State of the Union, and we'll look forward to that speech and take a look at some of the things the president is going to say about the budget. There's been a substantial amount of unrest during the day today in Yugoslavia, and we are watching that country with great interest. It may be the next country to renounce the Communist Party. And we have a long piece from Danny Zwerdling on Pakistani brides bought from Bangladesh.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like music, poetry has rhythm. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has been amusing himself lately by bringing the two arts together.
I never fully appreciated the art of setting poetry to music until about 10 years ago, when a bunch of us linguists cooked up the game of settings. The object was to find a popular song to which you could set the words of a well-known poem. The more ludicrous the match, the better. The original impetus for the game was the poet John Chardy's inspired observation that Robert Frost's poem Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening could be set perfectly to the tune of Hernando's Hideaway from Damn Yankees. You'll have to bear with me a little here. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening isn't too hard to find settings for, since it's written in iambic tetrameter, which happens to be the rhythm of a number of songs, ta-tum, 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 ta-tum. Another meter that works pretty well is trochaic tetrameter, tumta, 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 as in Longfellow's Hiawatha, or in Tennyson's Locksley Hall, which begins with, Comrades, leave me here a little while as yet tis early morn. You can set this one to the Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth, if you like. Comrades, leave me here a little while as yet tis early morn. Leave me here, and when you want me, sound upon the bugle horn. But that's sort of cheating, since the Ode to Joy was originally the setting of a poem by Schiller anyway. Besides, if you're looking for something a little more up-tempo, you could try My Darling Clementine. Comrades, leave me here a little while as yet is early morn. Leave me here, and when you want me, sound upon the bugle horn. But the real challenge of the game is to find settings for iambic pentameter, ta-tum, 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 as in, well, as in everything, but take, for example, a loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and thou. It is by far the most common meter in English poetry, and yet there are precious few popular songs that have that beat. There's an obvious reason. With the odd exception like Dave Brubeck, few popular musicians have played around much with lines that have five stresses. But that makes it all the more satisfying when you do stumble on a song that works as iambic pentameter. That Old Black Magic is one, and another is the Clover's Love Potion number 9. A book of verses underneath the bough, a loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and thou, and so on. But by far the happiest of happenstance settings for iambic pentameter is that old standby Finiculi Finicula. In fact, the tune seems ready-made for Hamlet's soliloquy on suicide. To be or not to be, that is the question, Finiculi Finicula. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer, Finiculi Finicula, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and so on. As it happens, there aren't many serious musical settings of English iambic pentameter either. But by way of compensation for the last few minutes, let me leave you with John Dowland's 1612 setting of John Lilly's lines, My Heart and Tongue Were Twins at Once Conceived, as performed by Emma Kirkby and the Consort of Music on a 1980 Decca recording.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with reporter John Hockenberry, who just returned to the States after close to 2 years covering the Middle East. And we meet Henry Hampton, the executive producer of Eyes on the Prize, the award-winning public television series about the civil rights movement. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.